Well, thank you very much. It's a distinct privilege to be with you today. Having attended Allegheny College in Meadville, which is about 90 miles north of here, this is a distinct pleasure for me. Allegheny, of course, is noted for many things, among them having become a wonderful college once I left there. Some of us have suggested a cause and effect. I'm certainly not one to deny. This speech will not include any images up here for three reasons. Number one, I am mechanically and cosmically technologically illiterate. Number two, the people that I'll be talking about were stunningly expert at images of the mind, images of the ear, not images of the screen. Number three, I do not wish to trespass upon your time at the end of my speech for questions by you. If we were to have images here, I would have to, in essence, define them, describe them. That would take away your time. So, let me begin by saying that we meet in America's baseball broadcast cradle. Yes, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The craft of describing baseball electronically began right here. August 5, 1921, to be exact, on America's first radio station, Westinghouse Company owned KDKA. Some of us will go by it tomorrow, in fact. Pirates 8, Phillies 5 at wondrous Forbes Field. What did baseball's first announcer, Harold Arlen, sound like that afternoon? Well, not surprisingly, no one lives to say. This region had only a few hundred sets in any event, KDKA debuting commercial radio the prior November. We know only that Arlen used to telephone his microphone, sat behind the screen, put a scorecard on a wooden plank, and chatted as around a stove. We were looking for programming, Arlen told me in 1985, the year before he died. So I went out to Forbes, he said, and set up shop. Often the transmitter failed him, or crowd silenced him. The pioneer didn't know whether he talked into a vacuum or anyone heard him. Didn't know, in fact, if he would ever broadcast baseball again. Well, he did through 1924, often heard by retail stores mounting sidewalk speakers, streets filled with play-by-play, like elevators with Muzak. One day, Arlen even Prince spoke for Babe Ruth, scheduled to read a speech on KDKA. I introduced him in studio, Arlen told me, and this big, garrulous guy, he can't say a word. Babe Ruth froze, I asked, as improbable today as Donald Trump deciding not to tweet. Mute, Arlen jabbed. I read his script on air, and now I'm Babe Ruth, as he tries to compose himself. You know something? He pulled it off. Arlen signed off. Meanwhile, Babe hadn't said a word. In 1925, the sound was Arlen himself signing off for a Westinghouse job in Nextdoor, Ohio. Surprised, a writer said, thousands of radio fans will regret loss of dear friend. That year, the Pirates won their first World Series since 1909 and sadly lasts till 1960. It's been a long time coming, sang Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. Bill Mazeroski would be a long time gone. Through 1935, Pirates radio was sporadic, even as Pie Trainer at third base victimized the league. A writer mused, so-and-so doubled down the left field line, and Trainer threw him out. Another saying then meant pie as well. For the unusual, go to Forbes Field. For the impossible, go twice. In 1936, the Bucks hired an announcer who found it nearly impossible for the Pirates to contend for the next 20 years as they cratered, becoming the Atlantis of the National League. Albert Kennedy Rosie Rosewell referenced anything not germane to score. A 112-pound humorous poet and great banquet speaker, the longtime secretary of Pittsburgh's Third Presbyterian Church, had attended every game at Forbes since its 1909 debut. Since he was out there anywhere and anyway, Bob Prince said years later, the Pirates figure he might as well do the game. Roosevelt did, adding one religion, baseball, to his other. quickly becoming what he proudly called himself, America's most partial baseball broadcaster. Also an alarm clock for the tri-state area. Housewives began dinner when Rosie signed off. Once 5,000 women listeners stormed the Bucks flagship station to see him recreate getting code by wire, thus to call a game unseen. Even school kids knew his prose. The Pirates were Picaroonies. Rosie's bases were FOBs, full of bucks. A doozy Maroonie was an extra base hit. A dipsy doodle, a strikeout. Oh, my aching back, he said, losing. Winning was tastier. I'll be home soon, he told wife Chip on air. Put on the lamb chops now. A frequent tangent became a Rosie ramble. In 1938, the Pirate's voice coined his Rembrandt of calls. One day, a Bucks drive was nearing the Forbes Field scoreboard when Rosie yapped, "Get upstairs, Aunt Minnie, and raise the window." Here she, the baseball, comes. An aide behind him then dropped a pane of glass. To listeners at home, it meant a window. "Oh, that's too bad," Rosie sobbed. "She tripped over the garden hose. Aunt Minnie never made it." In fact, she never did, but was never heard to grouse. Mal Allen cried of her homer, "Going, going, gone." Harry Carey closed a zillion bars, most of them himself. "It might be, it could be, it is," Harry Callis yelped. "It's out of here." Aunt Minnie dwarfed them all. Few criticized baseball's empress with no clothes. Knowing she was fictitious, people didn't care, said Prince, whose 1948 arrival as assistant changed Rosie's tack. Instead of glass, too messy, Bob had a dumbwaiter's tray with nuts and bolts and bells, anything to make noise. On Roosevelt's nod, Bob standing dropped it. On radio, it sounded like a four-car collision. Prince quickly picked up the nuts and bolts, saying, "I had to have the tray ready again, just in case the next guy hit it out." Bob had a lot of practice, especially with Ralph Kiner, the next guy, ready to hit one out. For 7 straight years, playing on the mostly awful 1946 through 52 Pirates, their Special K, Mr. Kiner, led the league each year in homers. In 1953, Kiner joined the Cubs. Next year, the Bucks added Weekend Road TV to radio's 20-station network. The Pirates pioneers once again. Segway to 1955. Rosie dies at 72. Prince becomes official voice, and the Bucks become the last big team to end road recreation, doing each game live. An Army brat, Bob Prince had been raised at 6 military posts and 15 schools and been scarred by a polo mallet, kicked in a rodeo, and jailed for vagrancy. In time, said the great and wondrous Steve Blass, Prince also had the greatest influence of any man who ever lived on baseball in Pittsburgh. In 1958, a new voice joined Prince on radio TV, so superbly matched that soon the Bucks led the majors in percentage of radio TV sets in use. Said Jim Woods, that partner, "Everyone said, Prince is out of control, you'll never get along. But I decided to try him on for size." Baseball's ringling brothers gilded Pirates broadcasting with a pencil and a scorecard. "That was it," said Bob. "We do play-by-play or tap dance if the ball game stunk." For the next 12 years, you could walk down the street in Newcastle and Oil City and Titusville and Meadville. I know, because as a college freshman I did. Anywhere in this area, and hear from a dozen directions perhaps baseball's all-time greatest duo. A fine play sparked Prince's, how sweet it is. A victory sparked, we had him all the way. A homer for us, you can kiss it goodbye. Woods once said, there are a reported 15,000 people at this game. If that's true, at least 12,000 of them are disguised as empty seats. Some felt Jim and Prince each a maniac. Both were maniacally riveting. Once Bob ripped some bucks about baseball being sedentary, knocking His slight figure, Gene Freeze, said, "Here's $20, Bob. You can't dive into this hotel pool." Bob, a college diver, made for his third-floor hotel room. "If he doesn't clear it, 20 feet of concrete," said Buck's trainer, Danny Whalen, "strictly a blotter job." Prince did. Much later, Woods recalled Bob's leap, asking, "How, Jack? Check out now, Bob." Prince replied, "One way to find out." Again, diving safely from a ledge. Woods was named the Possum after Enos Slaughter, citing his slight overbite and gray buzz cut jibe, "I've seen better heads on a possum." In turn, Woods named Prince Gunner after the husband of a woman Bob was talking to in a bar pulled a gun. In 1960, they recreated Mazeroski's Game 7 nine-inning homer to beat the Yankees 10-9 and win their first World Series since 1925. Prince called the blast, then said, "Possum, how did we do it?" Woods didn't know, only said, "I'm looking right now at the wildest thing since I was on Hollywood Boulevard the night World War II ended." For a long time, Maz's afterglow kept Buck fans aglow. So did voices who felt, like Roswell, quote unquote, that sponsors deserve fans and fans deserve a show. "Would Gunner settle down?" "I am," he said, "or at least my wife thinks it's time I did." In 1970, Woods left for St. Louis at a raise. In 1975, Prince was fired for, depending on your view, being too big for his britches or preferring showbiz to play-by-play. Milo Hamilton succeeded him, saying later, "I was vying with a ghost. I never tried to imitate him," meaning Prince, "but I couldn't escape him." Gunner did play-by-play from Henny Youngman via Milton Berle. Milo, well, by the book. Also hired in 1976 more successfully was Lanny Fritari, who knew that at Three Rivers Stadium, where the Bucks moved from Forbes Field in 1970, charm had to come from the team, since it certainly wasn't going to come from the park. In 1979, Lanny's Pirates won the World Series, led by Willie Stargell, the captain in every way, said Lanny. "Each team and each year, Pops grew as a person and as a player, hitting pitchers who threw left, right, and both-handed. As Yogi Berra said of pinch hitting and switch hitting, I think you'd call it amphibious." That year, Milo resigned. Fritari became lead voice, ultimately complimented by ex-Bucks pitcher and humorous Blass, who found the second division 80s a joke. On Memorial Day 1990, the Bucks rallied to beat L.A. A year later to the day they had Chicago, Fritari chiming, "It's Memorial Day all over again." How about 1991? The Pirates score 5 ninth-inning runs to tie the Cubs at 7. Chicago gets a 5 spot in the 11th inning. In its bottom half, Pittsburgh rolls 6, the Majors' then-greatest extra-inning rally. Or 1992, they made the league championship series. Fine team, sad slide by the brave Sid Bream. A decade later, the Pirates left Three Rivers for Grand PNC Park. For years, folks had said, Pittsburgh deserves a park worthy of the town. Now it just deserved the team. In 2001, Three Rivers said Hamilton had its greatest day, the day that it was blown up. That may be Milo's greatest slide as well. On another great day that year, Houston led 8-2 with 2 out in the home ninth at PNC. "Any other sport, it's over," said Fritari. Here the Bucks rallied. Brian Giles bombing a game-winning slam. Lanny unleashing his home run call. "Go ball, get out of here, it's gone." The team began to draw again, still losing. Lanny then retired after a record 33 seasons to teach. Greg Brown succeeding him, joining Blass to become the team's face and voice. Steve had won 103 games in his 10-year Bucks career. "Now we showed why we love the game." Blass liked to tell about my first big league homer, even though he couldn't recall much about it, except that it was September 5, 1969, came at 2:48 p.m. at Wrigley Field, Steve said. "The wind was out of the northwest at 13 miles an hour, overcast 61 degrees," said Ken Holzman was the pitcher. Blass hit the ball, got to first, and heard Coach Don Leppard say, "Take a left." Pitching, Steve had great friends. I'd look around and see Willie Stargell at first, Maz at second, and Roberto in right, three Hall of Famers behind me. My attitude was, hit the ball in their direction and I'm going out to get a sandwich. When I come back, you'll be out. In 1972, the hero of the 71 World Series had his greatest year. Next year, the control artist lost it, yielding as many walks in three times as many innings in 1971 as he had in 1972. His pitching coach, Steve, said, "Val, I got a new pitch for you." "Blast, what is it?" "Coach, a strike." Pitcher Danny Murtaugh gave Blast one more chance to regain his control. Steve told him, "I want 3 innings or 3 hours, whichever comes first." On Blast's first cable TV game with Bob Prince in the 80s, Bob called the press room to say, "Send up 2 screwdrivers. Now, since alcohol is banned in the booth, Steve naturally looked to see where the loose bolt was. Shortly, drinks arrived. "For 21 years, said a wag, missing the playoff, the only thing worse than watching the Bucks drunk was watching them sober. Then in 2013, out of the blue, a tri-stater heard Greg Brown crow, "Marte goes deep, the cannonballs come out. Polanco booms one, clear the decks, a McCutcheon homer. Pinching yourself, you still did not believe it. Nor that false epic wildcard game, PNC garbed in black and gold. Passion bursting through a screen, Sabre voted the Bucks resurrection, 2013's greatest baseball tale. That year revived the right of bringing Pirates bags and waving them around the park. And Brown, having started his career as a Bucks intern, coining the great phrase, raised the Jolly Roger. Today you can almost see Garland, Rosewell, and Prince smiling, Aunt Minnie trying to raise her window, and Woods and Fattari and Hamilton and Blass and the new kid on the block, Joe Block, kissing grief goodbye. The voices of the Pirates welcomed in and beyond Western Pennsylvania, Eastern Ohio, and West Virginia. How sweet it was and is, this cradle of baseball radio and television, baseball joy coming home where it belongs. Thank you very much. Pardon me, how much time do we have?
We got 5 minutes.
5 minutes, right on the button. Thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions? We've got a microphone here. I'd be happy to try to answer your erudite query with somewhat of an erudite response. Yes.
Jim Rucker of Philadelphia.
Yes.
10 run deficit.
Pardon me?
Jim Rucker down 10-0 in Philadelphia saying you walk home if they lose it. And they
won
that one. That's a
memorable.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I came to this because I kind of challenge your assertion that Prince and Jim Woods were the greatest star.
Well, I didn't say.
I think it's Ned Martin and Jim Woods.
Well, wait a minute. Wait. I have written to that effect.
I know. I just read about that.
I didn't say it's an assertion. I said it's a view. In fact, I have said in several books that the common denominator among those two teams is what? Woods. Jim Woods is the greatest number two, I use the term advisedly, in baseball history. He should be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, how come he was, that's my question. How did that get amazingly good?
Well, I should say this in terms of truth in advertising. I'm a member of the Ford C. Frick Award Committee in Cooperstown. It votes every year on the people to join the Hall of Fame, and it's broadcast to wing. Of course, the great, great Bob Prince is there. Jim Woods should be there. Ned Martin absolutely should be there. I tried, obviously, with no success last year to get him inducted. I tried with no success the year before to get Dizzy Dean inducted. Maybe I should campaign against them and then they would get inducted. That will be my next campaign ploy. You're absolutely right. Woods was a magnificent announcer and was with Martin. They will tell you that's the greatest in New England team. Here we will tell you that Woods and Prince, you know, there's no lose. They were both magnificent. absolutely magnificent. And if you do go to those towns that I mentioned, Meadville, Ashtabula, Oil City, Erie, they will tell you that it was, in fact, Woods and the Gunner, yes.
I thought you might want to bring up the story about Chicken on the Hill for those folks who are not familiar with it.
Well, Chicken on the Hill, when Willie Stargell came to bat, the Gunner would say, he would say, Wilbur, let's spend some chicken on the hill. Willie Stargell was the, I can't remember whether he was the full or partial owner of a chicken on the hill, of a Kentucky Fried Chicken restaurant on the hill, part of Pittsburgh. And whenever the Gunner, whenever Stargell came to bat, he would do that, just as he would. He made that a rallying cry, just as he did with babushkas. Babushkas is a Polish term for a handkerchief, or for a handkerchief that you can wear as a headdress as well. And he made it into a cause célèbre. He had an incredible ability to merchandise. If he had gone into political merchandising, perhaps both political parties would not be as pathetic as they are today. He was magnificent, and he was particularly, I should add, he was particularly charitable and kind to young broadcasters. If you doubt me, ask Manny Frattari, when he, in effect, had succeeded Gunner in 1976. Yes?
Jim Odenkirk, I'm so happy I had this chance. I enjoyed your book very much, which is kind of a pioneer book on announcers for baseball.
Thank you.
I wanted to clarify some things. First of all, Harold Arvin, since I could do this now, see, he was living here in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
Harold Arvin was the original baseball announcer in 1922 or 3. And lo and behold, my home was Mansfield, Ohio. And later on then, he became the general manager of Westinghouse, because this is the headquarters of Westinghouse. That's where it is. So he left there. The only other baseball thing he did was with his son, Steve,
right,
who went to Ohio State, my alma mater, and then came out and went to my school that I was teaching, which is Arizona State. And he won one year, but he lost the next year at Ohio State.
Right.
But lastly, I get so frustrated. You talked about going to Washington, D.C. Cleveland is really a heartbeat of baseball announcing. Tom Manning, back in the mid-20s, but most importantly, the first former ball player,
that's correct.
Jack Grady came on the scene about 1933.
Right.
I was in my teenage then about.
Yeah.
And so then, from him, he is not in the Hall of Fame. 20 years he announced for the Indians, and he also announced the 1935 World Series.
Right, yes he did, that's right.
Correct?
And yep.
All of that. So I would hope if you could, because of your background, if you just maybe call Mr. Bush, younger Bush, and ask him if he couldn't get Jack Grady into the Hall of Fame.
Well, I'm not sure he'd take my call.
What'd you say?
No.
That's my little story.
Thank you. Our problem with the Frick Committee is that we have so many deserving former announcers who deserve induction, but we can only induct one a year. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, yes, along those lines, of course, Chicago fans think of Jack Quinlan as being the great.
His problem was, and it was hardly his fault, he died after 10 years as a Cubs broadcaster. A tragic auto accident, yes.
As well. But the reason I'm up here, not only to thank you for your books, but also to make a suggestion. Pat Hughes has done a wonderful series of CDs.
He has.
Of great baseball announcers. And it emphasizes the fact that there should be, at some point, some kind of museum that preserves these great voices. I have always wanted to hear Rosie Roosevelt's open the window, Anthony, which I learned about many, many years ago, and I've always wanted to hear it. I'd love to hear Cal Cotton, great announcer in Chicago. I'd love to have the opportunity to hear some of the Jack Graney, for example. Is there any movement along those lines, and could you encourage that kind of thing? Because I think Pat Hughes' program is a good start.
It's a great start. Pat is the voice of the Chicago Cubs, a good friend, and a terrific broadcaster, and he has a terrific interest in and knowledge of baseball broadcast history. His series of CDs is really a wonderful tribute and enriches broadcasting. I would suggest that the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, which does exist, and would be a fine repository to approach.
That's a good idea, but I think it has to be a national effort because
well, this would be a national effort, but the problem is
the other recordings from
right. That would necessitate personnel, which of course means moolah. So.
Last question.
Last question. Okay.
Actually, not really a question. I hope I can keep it short. It's a reminiscence. Thank you for your talk. It was very good. Friends
Thank
of
you.
Mine now to between my ages. My
I'm sorry, who was now?
And he was the best he ever was.
Principal, yes.
What a homer. He was the best homer. And every year he'd come up with the Green Weenie.
The Green Weenie. I didn't have time.
Yeah. I mean, just terrific. Thank you.
Well, you're entirely welcome, man. He was a magician, in many ways. And Steve Blass may be right. He says that no one equaled the impact that Bob Prince had upon baseball in this area. I would suggest that probably he was right. Clemente obviously has a scintillating personality, and does so to this day. But Prince's duration here was longer. And what he could do with a touch of his promotional ploy was astonishing. So thank you all very much.